So are we recording? Okay, good morning and welcome everyone. My name is Tim Remus and I'm a member of the Potiphar's Affiliated Society. And I'll be just sort of briefly introducing and moderating today's teach-in. Today we have Jack Ross, author of The Socialist Party of America, a book-length history of that tradition, published in 2015. And we've asked Jack to give a teach-in on the Socialist Party of America tradition in the New Left period, how this tradition sort of changed and transformed and ultimately, in a sense, disintegrated, and why that was the case, roughly beginning in the 1960s and ultimately through the present. Three organizational forms, for example, that history has taken were the Social Democrats USA, the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, and the Socialist Party USA, the latter two of which are still in existence. And so we've asked Jack to kind of talk about the longer history of those three sort of tendencies that come out of this history of American socialism. What was the nature of the sort of contestation between them? What was at issue politically? And what does that mean for the legacy on the left today, of the legacy of left politics today? So Jack will speak for about, I think, maybe 15 minutes or so, 10 to 20, anything in there. And then after that, we'll have some open discussion and conversation. I know there are others in the audience who have some familiarity either with Jack's book or with the history that's at issue in our discussion today, or both. So in the interest of educating our own members and offering this recording for wider sort of education on the left, we're just going to encourage a kind of broad, open discussion of some key interpretations of this history as well. So with that, Jack, please begin.
Okay. Well, I'll probably in my remarks talk a little more about what led up to the split, less about the split itself than what led up to it, and not so much in organizational terms, but why the early history of the New Left itself was critical to this, and why the remnant of the Socialist Party in the late 50s and early 60s was so critical to the formation of the New Left and much of the Civil Rights Movement, and what I see the implications of that as being for contemporary liberalism and the left today. So, if you've read the book, you'll know that I divide it into three sections, and the dividing line, which is rather more consequential than between parts one and two, is between parts two and three, and that's in 1948, which was the last of the six consecutive presidential campaigns by Norman Thomas, and after that, with certain odd exceptions, Socialist Party effectively ceased to be an electoral organization, and so I won't go into too many details about the specific points of disintegration in the early to mid 50s. The key point is that what remained by 1956, 78, in 1958, what remained was taken over by a group called the Independent Socialist League, which was which was organized and led by someone named Max Schachtman, who was at one time very close to Leon Trotsky, and was one of the key figures in the foundational figures of American Trotskyism. Some will hotly dispute the extent. Certainly they were by this time reformed Trotskyists. They no longer believed in the dictatorship of the proletariat. But now I do go into some detail in the book about how this group began to grow in the early to mid 50s, and particularly through the figure of Michael Harrington, who at this time was a very young protege of Schachtman. You had Schachtman, who was much more an organizational genius than an original thinker, bring together the various shards and refuse that remained by the 50s of the pre-war non-communist left, particularly a lot of pacifist groups, which would be a major irony to those who know some of the later history of Schachtman and his core followers, and eventually what remained of the Socialist Party. And this really was in many ways the beginning of the New Left, or the earliest genesis of the New Left. Schachtman basically was trying to replicate the organizational success that he saw in the Popular Front in the 30s with the Communist Party toward an independent left. And they did become influential in the civil rights movement. Bayard Rustin basically began as in pacifist circles, as I'm sure many of you know, and as this organizational foundation was being put in place, became closer to Schachtman's core followers. So 1958 they take over the Socialist Party. 1959 they take a ghost of a youth organization from the 30s that was called the Student League for Industrial Democracy and rename it Students for Democratic Society. And then most people tend to focus on the Port Huron Conference as a real point of when divisions first appeared or ruptured, which they did, but I find to be of mostly secondary significance, or rather secondary to much more critical was when the Vietnam War began, and many of the founders of SDS, such as Tom Hayden, became openly partisan for the Viet Cong and saw this as an extension of the civil rights movement. and many of, most of the historic anti-war forces, who, as I mentioned, had come together under this organizational construct did remain decidedly anti-communist. And I think that the key point to understand is that when you look at three such wildly disparate groups that came, that only 1972, and really the end of 1972, all split apart, how were they ever in the same organization for as long as they were? And what became clear to me in the research is that after 1965, there still was the space for what you might call a moderate anti-totalitarian New Left, and it was only in the spring, by the spring or summer of 1968, that it became clear that this couldn't endure. It was only then that many of Shachtman's core followers began to more openly identify with the more hawkish elements of the Democratic Party and explicit support for the Vietnam War was rare. Most continued to obfuscate to one degree or another, and then. What was called the Debs Caucus, only organized in 1969, it became SPUSA, and then Michael Harrington only broke with the majority group, I think, a year before the split finally happened.
What year was the split?
1972, and what finally brought it was was the McGovern campaign it was less any explicit preference for the Republicans is just absolute viciousness toward McGovern and the whole New Politics movement. I'm guessing a lot of you would be familiar with New Class Theory, which first began to be popularized around this time, and that becomes very important to understanding. So I guess briefly a word on each of the three groups that came out of this split. The first was the core Shachtmanite group that became Social Democrats USA and essentially operated as, at least throughout the 70s, as a, I don't think it's an exaggeration to say, is essentially a Leninist vanguard around groups like the Coalition for a Democratic Majority and other of the early groups of neoconservatism when Scoop Jackson was still politically viable, and then basically when most of their members went into the Reagan administration, you had a low decline after that and formally passed out of existence in 2005, and then the Socialist Party USA, which was I know they nominated someone this year. Will they be on the ballot anywhere? 4 years ago, in three states. In my experience, It's maybe a few hundred people, a national office. I think it's just a room in the War Resistance League building in New York that's turned over by, it's no hyperbole to say, different set of infantile leftists every 2 or 3 years, and then the scattered locals, in my experience, really don't communicate with each other at all. You still have in one or two places a bunch of old timers who really have, they barely know that each other exists. And then Michael Harrington's group was originally called Democratic Socialist Organizing Committee, did become quite influential and does, I think, did leave a lasting imprint in its heyday on the left wing of the Democratic Party, much of which became the establishment. I mean, certainly they had a very large impact on the left wing of the labor movement in their day, that after 1995 became, or when John Sweeney was first elected, became very quickly the old guard of the labor movement. And that's actually a very good place to move on to why what this tells us about the present. And I mentioned the new class theory earlier. For the core Schachtmanites, this became a rallying cry. They retained a very old left attachment to trade unionism that retained throughout the transformation of their politics. So new class theory became a rallying cry for them about against the transformation of the Democratic Party. Harrington very explicitly argued the new class is a progressive conscience constituency that and these weren't the words he used, but basically envisioned this, them as taking a basically elitist vanguard missionary role in social uplift. And this I think has is I think quite profoundly anticipated what liberalism became in the last generation. I know Thomas Frank's new book, which I have bought but haven't read yet, I think very good to that effect. Going back to roots then, why would I say, I think it can be argued that, or at least from one perspective, that neoconservatism, having spoken about Social Democrats USA, the neoconservatism may be less a heresy from either Trotskyism or Cold War liberalism than from the New Left, having dealt with this early history. In other words, that
it's usually seen as a reaction to the New Left.
Well,
People talking about were people who hated the New Left. So
in much the way that I mean, the fact that a professor I once had said that made the point that you distinguish the right from conservatives. The right is simply the enemy of the left, and that from Mussolini to the neoconservatives, I think explains so much of why so much of the right in that distinction comes out of the left. And you could draw the analogy, whether it's narrowly that over Vietnam or Hawkins, or to a lesser extent, though that obviously did not last ultimately, the more old left labor right dissent from what the New Left is becoming, that both of these combined in a way. So what I see is the major implication of all of this for the history of liberalism, and why some of the very early history, going back even to the early to mid 50s, of the origins of the New Left remain significant. And I think it does go back to, I think it does ultimately go back to the way that Max Schachtman replicated the Popular Front strategy, and how the central role they played in the civil rights movement ultimately reinforced this, which was the elevation of protest over politics. And actually politically organized, politically engaged, and focused if you know anything about the historic Socialist Party, they were very deep believers in the ballot box and the redemptive power of the ballot, and how this changed the emergence of, I think, of the Popular Front strategy in the 30s. I think was the critical turning point at which this changed. But when you're talking about what remained and to whatever extent was reconstructed of the non-communist left in the 50s by adopting this strategy and then seemingly vindicated and reinforced by the civil rights movement, where protest was necessary because of the failure of politics, that this became the idealized form and set the pattern for which progressive movements would relate to. To put it in more concrete historical terms, think about 1968 election, its long shadow on the left, and why a lot of the founding New Left ideologues, like Tom Hayden, as well as some of those to the right of him that I'd mentioned, and there's a story about how at Bobby Kennedy's funeral that Hayden and Harrington entered a weeping embrace, and after very bitter separation, some of you might have read some of Christopher Lash's contemporary criticisms of the New Left, and
come from just some extent the tradition you're talking about, the Shakthin Rite.
To some, well, more for also this position. I mean, he drew more on James Weinstein in his circle, and took both the good and bad from it. But it seems odd in with the passage of half a century, how someone like Bobby Kennedy could have this appeal to new leftists, but basically he appealed to the foundational premise that someone like Hayden was so committed to, and that Christopher Lash was quite notably critical of the idea of radicalism based on marginal people organizing at the margins of society, and that this ultimately, even at the height of the Vietnam War, could supersede the more directly anti-war, old-fashioned liberal appeal of someone like Eugene McCarthy, who later McGovern, and so to put it in current terms, I think one can say about a lot of liberal disillusionment with Obama that this is basically what would have happened with a lot of the new leftists if Bobby Kennedy had actually ever become president. And I mean, in retrospect, with the obvious exception of outpouring of African American support, the belief in Obama as a transformational figure is very much an elite phenomenon, and a lot of it was from aging liberals of that era who were going back to this earlier construct about Bobby Kennedy, and whatever people's opinions in this room are about the Bernie Sanders campaign. I think that is a very important point as far as understanding what the differences and the significant differences are between the two campaigns and who they're appealing to and why. So having brought it up to such contemporary terms, I'll open the floor.
Excellent. So last night you made a very provocative statement that was sort of left hanging, and I love your expression. So you said at one point that you felt that the end of the Cold War had the danger of losing a consciousness, I don't know the words, of the positive value of anti-communism.
Well, value is plural.
Positive values, okay.
Yeah,
values.
That's important.
And so you also sort of refer to like the idea of an anti-totalitarian left. One of the central themes of the new left was anti-communism. And I'd like you to talk about like how you see your seeing, let's say, values of anti-communism versus like a new left idea, not of necessarily communism, but anti-communism.
Well, I think the new left was always too temporally provincial, that there were a number of even understandable reasons. I mean, certainly the specter of nuclear war had a lot to do with shaping the psychology, which is easy to find fault with or seem dubious today, but obviously it was something very real then.
So would your
I
go
What I talk about in the book was a lot, but I mean, the reason that, I mean, I don't want to sound, I don't want to sound like what older scold of that era would say, but indeed the reason that a lot of them were so effective is because they had been through such an experience of, they had been through the whole experience of the world ending and beginning again in World War II, and they could not deal with a lot of the real implications of their own radicalism. How many of these people were on, had been, how much of the non-Congress left had been isolationist, and it's not that a lot or even most of them couldn't be honest about that. Some weren't, but I think on the one hand it's myopic to suggest, as one review of my book, which also completely misread my argument about the period we're talking about, incidentally. To argue that this was all just generational struggle repeating itself, whether in the 30s or the 60s or even later. I mean, but I have somewhat lost track. So to bring it back to your specific point, I think. I guess the short answer is that in a larger historical perspective, it becomes clear that whatever can be said about the reasons, a lot of those values were always lost.
But you talk about like the despair of the party over like the progressive campaign of Wallace, right? Like you mentioned 1948, right? When lots of liberals were backing not the socialist candidate, but like a former Democrat, who was also backed by the Communist
Party. These were all Congress fellow travelers. The bitterness between them and the socialists, the chasm between them and the socialists was there for at least a decade by that time. That's not exactly,
wasn't the Socialist Party to some extent echoing anti-communist criticism of Wallace? I mean, the question is, criticizing
obviously
from
it was.
The left and from the
I'm
right.
Not sure you're. I'm not sure what your point is. What I should say is, this crisis of values obviously did already exist in the early Cold War and probably rather longer than that. Obviously, there was never any ideal liberalism. What's been lost? What began to be lost was any sense of the positive values of what should be, or any frame of reference for how they.
Can you be more specific about what values you're talking about?
Well, liberalism, in a word.
And you're seeing like a Bolshevik tradition is kind of posted.
Isn't really about, not Bolshevik, if we're talking about the post-war era.
Or you're just talking about Stalinism?
Social democracy?
Or the legacies of these things. I mean, I thought it was a premise of this discussion that we're treating the New Left as something entirely distinct.
But you seem to be saying the New Left harked back to things that were earlier.
Precisely.
So that's what we're trying to unpack, because you're talking about how the earlier politics affected the New Left. So we're trying to understand how you see that.
Okay, well, the question is, we're talking about an organizational form. We're talking about what came of putting that form into practice at that time. It's not ultimately about the content of.
So you think the content,
the ideological content.
So that's just gone in the 60s, is what you're saying? And what remains is like this like empty shell of, I don't know, like Leninist organization or something? Or socialist organization from the late 19th century? What do you mean by the content being sort of missing? What remains? What gives the form? What form does it take, and like where does that come from?
Okay, I'm not sure exactly what we're talking about. Are we talking specifically about what remained of the Socialist Party? Are we talking about Leninism in a larger sense? Are we talking about?
If I could jump in, I think maybe one continuity that jumped out to me in terms of the kind of old left influencing the new left was the kind of popular front approach, that even though it was a different political tendency, it was taking up the organizational strategy.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. And the consequences of doing that are, what I'm talking about are the consequences of how they organized and what came of and what sprang from the strengths and weaknesses of applying the organizational form to the time and place and circumstances they were in. I mean, we could talk about the rise of the pro-CP historiography in the 70s and as a reaction to some of this. That's not really our topic today. That's just to make the point that, yes, obviously the new phenomenon is settled and one looks for usable past, there are reasons that they might look at a particular usable past as opposed to another, but we're not talking about direct continuity or about, you have a question?
So I just wanted to make sure I understood what you were saying about the three different groups that came out of the 72 split. So there's the Shakhbin Knights who, like, I think you were saying, they were relying upon this like popular front concept. They had this popular front concept, which then influenced their impact on the civil rights movement to turn it into this elevation of protest over politics.
Right.
And then on the other hand, you have Michael Harrington with the left wing of, who eventually like comprised the left wing of the left wing of the actual Democratic Party, and then had an impact on the labor movement. And I would see both of those groups as actually Stalinized, right? It seems like both of those groups have, both of those groups are referenced in popular
front. That's a loaded word, but in the sense you mean, yes. No, they only came apart because of, not even because of Vietnam, but because of circumstances in the late stages of Vietnam. I mean, I certainly assign most of the bad faith to the right wing chairwrights, who basically you just had. But yes, we're basically just talking about a fairly straightforward left right split, which came to roughly correspond with with the left-right split within the Democratic Party, and to a considerable extent, it could even be said that what was the left then is by this current decade become the right wing of the Democratic Party. It certainly became very quickly evolved into the old guard of the labor movement in the 90s, early 2000s, if you follow, however ridiculous it seems in retrospect, the split in the labor movement in 2005, if you followed, it was that the old guard that was behind Sweeney was very deeply rooted. Yes. It corresponded with the unions that had backed Harrington and D. Sox.
I'd like to let
finish.
So my question was, it seems like actually what you're saying is these three groups coming out of 1972, in a way, both the Shachtmanites and the Michael Harringtonites are on the same side of the split in a way, right? Because they're both Stalinistically making reference to, they both are, like, underlying both are, is this concept of the Popular Front, right? So it seems like you're saying the only thing that really came out that isn't actually totally subject to the Popular Front or Stalinist politics is SPUSA, and my question would be, so I think maybe some people had the understanding that the New Left become Stalinized at some point, but it seems like you're saying the New Left was, like, in its very origins, it's already making reference to the Popular Front of the 30s.
Okay, that's certainly true of DSA and Harrington.
I have to make the point that
as far as SDUSA, the clique that became SDUSA before the split, that they did become increasingly very sectarian. It went once they really began to identify with the Humphrey Jackson wing of the Democratic Party. And for the very early just couple of years of SDUSA, there still were manifestations of that very sectarian attitude, but it was not very long before you saw the ghost of that fade away. So that's very important to point out. And as for DSA, they were very open, or many, at any rate, were very open about emulating a Popular Front strategy for social democratic ends. You asked about SPUSA, though, and they're a rather more interesting case. They did set up, I mean, the reason I felt as not so relevant as they may be to this discussion, the reason I felt they did merit their own chapter is because There is a story to be told about why a formidable third party of the left did not emerge in the 70s. And they were part of a milieu that seemed to be coalescing into that for much of the 70s. You had the Peace and Freedom Party and loosely related state parties that ran Benjamin Spock and 1972, you did have a large segment of more traditional new leftists who, for a while, who might have been so inclined, and I felt it was important to tell that story and why it didn't happen,
But wasn't part of the appeal?
I'm sorry, Bernard has a question.
Part of the question was when I actually asked the question. But what I also wanted to follow up, wasn't part of the reason for the failure of SPOSA, the appeal in the 70s of Leninist parties to the fragments of the New Left? That's my question.
That's a completely other discussion, which is an important topic and a not insignificant part of the reason of why it failed. That's a bit beyond our discussion today.
So the Socialist Party was a major party. Why ideologically couldn't it adapt and stay together as a sort of democratic socialist party as opposed to, say, the CP? What were the ideological reasons they couldn't?
Well, are you talking about why they couldn't adapt as, or are you talking about in the 60s as a non-electoral organization, or are you talking about earlier as a more traditional political party?
As a political party, why did they fail, basically? What do you think is the major reason for the failure?
But if you're asking about as a political party, we're talking about before
48.
Yeah, and that's not really not the topic here.
So you say that would harken back to like the First World War?
I suppose this is important to preface in this book I begin from the premise that party system as it exists or as it evolved should not be taken for granted. If the premise of your question, which and I think it is should the Socialist Party have adopted its own Popular Front strategy in the 30s, as opposed to trying to continue to be a traditional political party. Is that your question?
Well, everything we're talking about later in the Socialist Party happened because of what happened earlier. So it's the cause that led it into what it became, and splitting into three parties eventually.
Well, yes and no, and probably more no, because you're dealing with a number of different factors come into play. One was the decline and collapse of the Communist Party in the 40s and 50s, and why the contingencies of the Cold War gave the opening to whatever alternative could emerge. And I suppose you do have to go back to why in the 30s. I argue in the book about I have an art about why should be pointed out as far as the 30s go that it was only after the 1936 election that the Communist Party became unambiguously behind the New Deal as well, that as far as what the possibilities for a realignment occurring outside of the terms of the New Deal or the two-party system, I mean, I'm not sure what I suppose, though, it's problematic to take for granted that, or to assume what the end result would have been for the communists in that process. I mean, I take it for granted that the goal of the communists was never to form a labor party on their own terms, certainly by the 30s and by the mid 30s. But I mean, taking for the sake, I mean, I don't know that that could have gotten very far. I make a case for why one organized on the terms of Socialist Party might have gotten reasonably so, but I guess what I'm saying is I mean the contingencies, at least up through the 36 when Roosevelt was reelected and for all practical purposes, though events after 36 I obviously don't consider unimportant.
I just wanted to give an opportunity for anyone else in the audience to pose any questions. Otherwise, Richard can go ahead, but I just want to make sure we get some other voices in. We've got about 25 more minutes.
So, I mean, you know, listening to you, I was like thinking about, there's the famous or infamous comment of John Wilkes, the American writer, when someone asked him why he, in 32, I think, why he joined the Communist Party instead of the Socialist Party, and he said he didn't want to drink a glass of near beer. And it seems to me that when you look at the sentiment in the 30s, that people who were drawn to something left of liberalism, there was the sense of, well, if you're going to go to the left of liberalism, you want to go to communism. And I think you have a kind of reputation.
That was still, at the time he made that statement, that sentiment was still basically limited to an intellectual elite.
Right.
That changed over the course of the next number of years. And even really, through 36. I mean, it was not, it was a complicated relationship from all points on the map between the socialists and the communists and the broader farmer labor movement and, yes, the Huey Long and Father Kaufman movements, and the interaction was complex, and I try to do justice in the book, but I make that point to say where a base of popular support was, and if you've ever read if you've read the Alan Brinkley book on the Long and Kaufman movements, he basically concludes by making the point that even they, who had the largest mass followings, not that mass following is everything, but that even they it was clear were representing the last gasps of a declining tradition, respectively. The Communist Party only came to have anything resembling a mass following by virtue principally of the CIO unions it came to control, but even there, even then, that they even then their influence on any kind of mass level was limited. So
I understand that, but since part of what we're talking about is not like mass movements in the European type, but the influence of these groups, including the Socialist Party, on American politics, like isn't it, like my impression is that people who are being radicalized, like in the 30s, young radicals, that particularly those who are more intellectual, were either drawn to the Communist Party or the Trotskyists. Very few of them, except those who were in the Trotskyist movement and then entered the Socialist Party, were drawn to the Socialist Party itself. And then, like, you have this other group, which you see as like founding neoconservatism, but these are people who came into the Socialist Party from outside through like a particular trajectory through the Trotskyist movement. So I'm thinking that the question is like isn't that part of also what goes into like the new left historiography that you criticize, the sense that people who passed through or were influenced by the communist movement, that it had this sort of broader percolation in terms of intellectual currents. And I mean, I'm not speaking particularly as a partisan of the communist movement, and I appreciate your book a lot, but I'm just saying like isn't that also part of the story? Because none of these were by European standards mass movement, but one of the things that people often don't realize is the extent to which like the Communist Party or people who went through the Trotskyist movement had a kind of cultural influence or political influence through certain political mass movements that was disproportionate to what we normally see, right? Organizing the CIA or the civil rights movement, right? A lot of the key actors in this were people who were, in one sense or another, Marxists or radicals, right? And you mentioned that also about the socialists in terms of the civil rights movement. So I'm talking about like the way the Socialist Party is perceived. Like if you see that as a problem.
Do I see it as a problem? Okay, so is your question, do I perceive it as a problem that the Socialist Party is perceived as having that kind of, as opposed to a mass?
Well, it's not like the Communist Party was a mass party.
Or no, as a, but,
or
yeah,
the
so
Nazis, but it so, seems.
So how do I see the Socialist Party? Well, certainly after 48 and definitely earlier, yes, that's clearly what its importance is. And I mean, whether you can properly the extent to which you can even properly characterize it, with the specific case of the civil rights movement, it's complicated because you had an earlier legacy through A. Philip Randolph and others, in addition to the Shacknerites, but in most other respects, can you call that a historic socialist influence? If you're talking about this, the story of the 30s, as I see it, is why it did not. And I'm merely trying to tell the story on its own terms. Why the Socialist Party did not, why it did not become why it did not become a, if not a mass party, certainly a once again a healthy, normal political party in the 30s, and why then it's made the, and why at the same time that did not happen, but at the same time you had the influence of, you had a similar kind of influence on the founding Cold War liberalism, for sure, among other things. Why those things, why that, the 30s, the story is, on the one hand, why it did not become something more than that, but at the same time, ultimately became this. And then, as you get later on, it becomes more explicit, but then the question is the issue is to what extent are you still talking about the historical tradition, and if you're not, why not?
If I could pose Richard's question a little bit, although maybe I'm misunderstanding it doing so, but I think part of the question is when you look at the history of the left in the United States in the 20th century, and even the history of the United States in the 20th century as such, to what degree could you say that kind of conscious radicals and Marxists in particular kind of exerted an outsized political influence on the course of events? Certainly, for example, in the vast majority of popular education and consciousness on the civil rights movement, the name Max Shackman is virtually unknown, except to those who, you know, make themselves aware of this deeper history. And so your account, from what I gather, would seem to give a kind of perhaps refreshing and unusual private place to kind of the center of the right traditions within the kind of Socialist Party tradition. But I take Richard to be asking in part, like, kind of how do you understand the agency politically of Marxists in particular with respect to this history?
I guess, like, what I'm...
I accept the premise that Marxist in itself is a distinctive taxonomy to this discussion, but Richard.
Well, I guess I was just like thinking, like, when you talk about the Socialist Party, but in the narrative you present, obviously there's the split that gives rise to the Communist Party, and then there's a further split that gives rise to Trotskyism, and then the Trotskyists enter the party, the Socialist Party, in the 1930s, and then that's certainly significant in the history of the Socialist Party, and then there's the further history of a certain wing of Trotskyism, which eventually comes out of the Shackmanites, which then enters the party in 58, which you then tell the story in great detail about the influence of that on the split. So I guess what, and it does seem to me like, even if you say, well, the New Left or the Stalinist historians have exaggerated, it does seem to me that the Communist Party was more influential than the Socialist Party in the 30s. So the question is like what accounts for that, right? In other words, why did the Communist Party appeal more to people who wanted something radical than the Socialist Party in the 30s? And why is it that, for example, you talk about the Socialist Party USA, in the 70s, most of those new left radicals, they could have gone into the Socialist Party USA, but mostly they went into various Trotskyist or Maoist parties, or some of them went into the CP. So my question is, why in those crucial moments did the Socialist Party find itself outcompeted by these other leftist groupings, however you want to characterize them?
Okay, so, as I stated in the introduction of the book, when I'm writing about the 30s, and I say this is what, the way I frame my old approach to the 30s is the way James Weinstein approached his book, Decline of Socialism, and the book is Decline of Socialism, 1912-25, which remains, I shouldn't discount my own book, but anyway, his whole premise was to, as he put it, the decline of the split of the Communist Party and decline as a single process. And my approach to the 30s is to treat it as a single process, how the Communist Party came to displace the Socialist Party and influence, which was a much longer and more complicated process than most historians have treated. It was fairly late, to the extent you can make any single pinpoint at all. And it was not it was certainly not simply a story of the Socialist Party, its ancient history, the Communist Party is the thing of the 30s. It's true that in the case of the Socialist Party, certainly by the mid 30s, or over the course of the 30s, it became increasingly reliant on a much broader non-communist left, in which it did operate much more and increasingly over time along the lines Richard is describing. So, I mean, the issue for me is not so much moral or value judgments, except insofar as I make an argument about what was lost in all of this. As for the Evendies, I mean, that strikes me as a rather odd question on many levels, not least of which that this had all but disappeared by the end of the decade, or certainly the very early 80s, the various sectarian movements. But
something like the Socialist Workers' Party or the Communist Party were much bigger in the 70s than the Socialist Party. You could have imagined in a kind of counter history many of the people coming out of the New Left, like the people who went into the New American Movement. A lot of those people.
Well, there was. I mean, now we're getting. I mean, the beginning of your question bringing the 70s into it. I mean, the rise and fall of Maoism is a whole other subject, but.
Right, but so then the question is, again, the same question, but a lot of these new left radicals, right, were attracted to Maoism, right? Mm-hmm. They weren't attracted to the Socialist Party. Those who were not going into the Democratic Party directly and were not attracted to Maoism were attracted to Trotskyism, or they were attracted to the Communist Party in some cases. But so the question is, why by that point had the Socialist Party lost all of its attractive power to this new generation of radicals? In that sense, and sort of, you could imagine.
Well, you mentioned NAM, which did not come up, and I basically write off in its importance to how DSA became DSA or the DSA that most of you know. And as I argue in the book, the story of NAM is to a large extent the story of how over the course of the 70s the remnants of the New Left changed in a rather drastic way, and I guess they in their earliest years were more inclined to merging with the Decent Freedom People's Party and SPUSA. That was the original, what was originally anticipated early on. And then they, many of them became, once Vietnam was receding into the past, that the people who briefly grew those larger sectarian groups were people who had whose crisis of commitment was brought on by that, as opposed to any, as opposed to anything earlier or had more enduring. I mean, in other words, it seems to me that people who would have been involved in a group like that, and who would have been attracted to the kind of perspective, formidable third party of the left in the 70s, already knew who they were, already very, had a much better sense of who they were for a much longer time. It was the more deeply radicalized element that would have only had that crisis after Vietnam and briefly populated some of the Maoist groups. I should take that opportunity, a point that I perhaps should have made at the beginning, and that I make explicitly in the book, which is the profound misreading of the anti-war movement in a lot of this, in a lot of these histories by Maoists. The reason the anti-war movement was a mass movement was the draft, and that basic libertarian concern betrayed a fundamental disconnect, both from the founding ideologues of the New Left, like Tom Hayden, and what their ambitions became by the 70s, and as well certainly from the SWP or Maoists, on the other hand.
To correct me if I'm wrong, but weren't, for example, a lot of the big peace marches organized essentially by either SWP front groups or Communist Party front groups? Like, weren't a lot of
SWP. I mean, they did make, I don't know the finer details, but they made a very concerted attempt, beginning around 69, to essentially achieve a loose hegemony over anti-war movement. They never quite succeeded, but I imagine most of us in this room are familiar, have vivid memories of anti-war protests in the Iraq period. Workers' World Party basically replicated that strategy and succeeded, but quickly found it to be a dead end.
At this point, I just want to signal that we have a few minutes left, so I'd like to invite Richard and Wentai to ask questions. I know they each have them. Does anyone else have questions that they would like to contribute to the discussion before we wrap up? Okay, so we'll hear from Richard and Wentai, and then Jack would like to answer those questions, make any closing remarks.
Okay, so I really don't have that. Just to follow that up, I mean, but then the question is, did the Socialist Party try to get involved in any anti-war organizing in competition with the SWP, because I know that the CP did, and was sort of outmaneuvered.
Well, by that time, no, it essentially all came down to split. I mean, the Dems caucus had its newspaper and reached out to whoever it could. Early on, the early protests, at the beginning of the war, or a whole other story that I mentioned earlier in my talk, but Wentai?
Well, this is more of a kind of follow-on to Richard's previous question about why the Socialist Party was never able to attract the kind of mass appeal that other tendencies did. And I feel that, like, the question that almost precedes that question is why did the Trotskyists fail to attract, like, a similar mass appeal? Because it seems like if we're going to bring this history back to the 30s, the fundamental, like, question of, like, again, why did these political parties fail or so forth, is the question of, like, the historical crisis of the leadership of the proletariat, the diagnosis of that, and then the failure of Trotskyism to deal with that diagnosis. Right, and it seems like that's one part of your question, and then the next part of your question is like, it's how that history of Trotskyism, how that failure is what makes us actually harken back to the Socialist Party because it has a different kind of trajectory in that history. Does that make any, I guess my question is, are we kind of interested in like Socialist Party history because of how it plays out alongside Trotskyism or with Trotsky, right? Because it seems like from what you're saying, like it and the Trotskyist tendencies would have been the exceptions in the New Left the exceptions in the New Left in terms of they were not Stalinized, whereas the rest of the New Left was Stalinized or Maoified.
Well,
Kim, you wanna?
Wait, sorry. Maybe that doesn't make sense.
You seem to have a distinction, right? I'm not sure whether there's a question there, or are you trying to ask the fundamental question why, or.
Oh, my one question was, what was, why, you know, is it actually something about how Socialist Party history plays out alongside or with the history of Trotskyism in the U.S. that makes us interested in the Socialist Party?
So I have to intervene.
Okay.
Cam, I'd like to give you about 30 seconds, and then
yeah,
you can take no more than about two or
I feel
three
like
minutes
the,
to respond, and then we'll focus.
I feel like what Richard's been digging towards, if I know Richard, is the fact, or the impression I have, because I haven't read that extensively on the Socialist Party, just one or two things, is that the Socialist Party kind of like punted on the issue of the Soviet Union, whereas other people had something a lot more definitive and clear to say about how that should inform politics. And that the kind of ambiguity in their position on the Soviet Union informs things up until the 60s when you have the Shakmanites and you have how to relate to the anti-war movement and the Vietnam War, which
not,
like paralyzes them during the anti-war movement.
What do you mean by ambiguity?
I mean, you have a faction in the party that is militantly anti-communist,
yeah,
coexisting with a faction that doesn't want to replicate Soviet communism, but certainly doesn't want to enable the United States to go drop napalm on it either.
But they're still anti-communist. I mean, anti-communism is not a difference. There is not a difference. The difference is much more. Let me close by trying to say something in response to what Wentai seemed to be getting at, which is why did it not endure that kind of small D democratic New Left, which, depending on who exactly you're talking about, certainly Hal Draper, along with some others who could include some Trotskyists or semi-Trotskyists under that heading. I mean, I guess in the book I draw the question too narrowly when I say of SPUSA, the most fundamental reason that a party did not emerge is that opposition to two-party system contradicted the core founding doctrines of the New Left, which, following this popular front strategy, emphasized the transformation of the Democratic Party. That in itself I wouldn't call mutually exclusive to what we're talking about. I suppose there's and it is certainly also, and it, I certainly do also say that it clear that with what was happening that with respect to SDS as well as Maoist, why why it didn't endure. I mean, I guess it comes down to an argument about why such a politics, if on the one hand it contradicts core doctrines of the New Left, and I would argue also other conceits of the New Left, about why that breaks down if you're dealing with modern party system. But I guess I would just conclude, to bring it back to the present, that when I say there's a story to be told about that period in the 70s, and when I said this as I was writing and wrote the book, I had no idea, I could never have imagined to just how great an extent it could turn out to be, that the most significant legacy of that period is Bernie Sanders, who, after things more or less fell apart by the end of the 70s, ran for mayor of Burlington as an independent in 1981, and the rest is history.
So that is an excellent note on which to announce that right now, taking place in this room, is a workshop featuring Bernard Sampson of the Communist Party USA and Jason Shulman of the
next door. That's the next room.
Oh, sorry, next room.